Accession number 10403, rule 13.
Mr. Harold Sell, Reel 13. So, you got your new brigade commander.
Yes.
What happened next? That you'd been frozen in?
Yes, and then we were still digging our defences where we could. We were still working and doing a bit of training. We used to organise wild boar hunts, and then when we shot a boar or two, that went into the pot, and everybody had some fresh meat for a change. It wasn't a sterile period. I remember going into Mosul to arrange a Christmas Day treat for the troops and found there's a cinema there. And went into the cinema and through an interpreter and negotiated the hire of this cinema and found that he had some whatever reels he had, we didn't mind, and they were all hand reels. And when we went to the show, we found that the reels were put on. It didn't matter what order they were put on, whether they were put front or back. And then we found it was a serial of the Three Musketeers written in German in preparation for when the Germans came through and took the place over. The clientele got very excited in one of the episodes because it was an open cinema with an end, and they were all armed, of course. They always were armed. And when the buddy got the upper hand, they all lifted their bandooks and fired five rounds rapid into the screen, which cheered everybody up. We bought things from the bazaars. We went on recces right the way through into Iran. Brigadier and I went on several recces into Iran and up towards the border, because we never knew when we might have to go on. And in digging our defences, we had to, the 9th July, had to dig through a Mohammedan churchyard. Well, this was a very tricky situation, religion-wise. So we waited on the Mukhtar and explained what we were going to do. And after due deliberation, he came back and said, "Ah, well, now, that could be all right, but the bones of the faithful had to be respected, and that we could not dig through it until we had a proper representation from the imam to see that everything was done properly and reverently." He then added that there was a small charge which amounted to 5 dinars, which was 5 quid, which we paid. He drew up a voluminous document written in Sanskrit or something, I don't know what it was, but nobody could make head and tail of it, but we solemnly had the document, he solemnly got the 5 dinars, and then the company of infantry the next day at the appointed time arrived at the place to dig. The imam's representatives did not appear. We sent for the imam, and he explained in the best way he could, very subtly, in which he said, "Ah, yes, well, now that we had paid the 5 dinars, the formality of having a representative present would be waived." So we just carried on. It was very interesting. We found the remains of an early Christian burial place up there. And there was a stone sarcophagus, which we learned later after having notified the archaeologists, that it was a very early Christian burial. On one side of this sarcophagus was a representation of the Lord's Supper in effigy. And on the other side, it must have been at the time when Christianity was just a new religion, because on the other side, the relatives who weren't converted to the new religion and were rather suspicious had inscribed a message to the gods not to take too hard a line with the deceased, as he wasn't a bad lad anyway. And so that was the type of country that it was.
You mentioned trying to get some entertainment, a treat for the troops
yes.
at Christmas. Was it difficult to keep the troops amused in such inhospitable circumstances, winter and not particularly friendly locals?
Well, we used to get quite a lot of fresh meat. That is to say, we used to organise shooting parties and shoot these big giant bustards that were up there. There was millions of grouse. Game was all over the place. So food-wise, we were able to maintain a good supply. We could get plenty of chickens. And in fact, going into Mosul, we could send a convoy into Mosul. And the local bazaars, there would be a terrific amount of fresh food, fresh fruit. And we bought a lot of fresh fruit. So that feeding-wise, I think the troops did better there than they might well have done. Entertainment, I think the troops entertained themselves. Every troop, every platoon had its local wag, or he had his banjo, or he had something. And, Sergeant Cutty of the 8th DLI had brought a duck with him, which he'd a little baby duck that he'd brought from England. And that accompanied us all the way through the Middle East. And that was the mascot, was the duck. And they all had things of that nature, which was a great help.
So the morale was reasonable?
Oh, it was very high, because, you see, we got mail about once a month. Once 3 weeks or a month, it might have been a fortnight sometimes. We got all sorts of things sent up. So apart from the initial problem and hardship and inconvenience and being rough when we got there to get there, once we got established, we were all right. But of course, it turned out just like everything else in war. You never know what happens. And whilst we were preparing for that, somewhere about the February, might have been the end of January or the February, brigade commander sent for me and said, the battles in the desert have gone sour, and the division and the brigade must get back and get into the desert. So the only words I got was, look, you get off and see that everything's all right along the pipeline so that we can get back. And as soon as you see everything and the troops are entering Palestine, get yourself down through Palestine, go by way of Beersheba or even more south than that, get across the Sinai, report into GHQ in Cairo, and after that make your way over the desert, not by the roadway, by the desert route, get yourself into Tobruk. And we'll take it from there. And so there again, I just shot off.
Would you keep in communication, when you were on these detached missions,
yeah,
would you have a wireless set or anything to keep in touch with your brigade?
I had a number 19 set, which the signaller here, or we get from long distances, you could get on Morse. But we used wireless silence, but at periodical places where I knew the troops would be following up, I always left a report with whoever happened to be there to how I'd got, what information I had, and what was my next move? That was always left behind, a pickup. So I just shot off.
So how did the journey go?
Well, it went very well. I went down there. I was familiar with the route, more or less the route across the desert. But this time I didn't go to Haifa, of course. I went straight into Jerusalem. And then I reported at the GHQ at Jerusalem. Had a night in the transit camp there. And
what exactly were you doing as well? What would you do while you were in Jerusalem to help your brigade? What would you be sorting out?
I wouldn't be sorting anything out. What I'd be doing is I gave to the AQ department the composition of the force, its ration strengths, and the plans as I knew it, and they would then make certain that at various stopping points they would have representatives to meet them, ration them up, petrol them up, and look on with them. They say that was part of the job. It was
Would the other brigades have sent an officer on a similar mission, probably the staff?
Oh, yes. I mean, this is the sort of things that you do, that you do this sort of thing. you go off in small parties, and you get it becomes second nature.
You wouldn't travel with the other staff, the deputy quartermasters, though.
You wouldn't travel with anybody. You wouldn't travel with the staff captain of another brigade. We were a little group on our own, and we were always moving on our own. And that worked very well.
So after Jerusalem?
Well, Jerusalem, I looked at the map and I took some advice. And I was advised to go down the road by the Jordan, by the Dead Sea, and then go south to Beersheba. Well, I did that, and then I came across the railway line that Lawrence used to blow up when the Turks were doing in World War One, and I went down there for some distance, the desert, across the Sinai, and I went, I think it was either through the Mittler Pass, is it, or the Mittler Pass, as it was, however, I forget what it was, and arrived in... arrived in Cairo, well, not far from Cairo, Tel El Kebir, somewhere like that. Anyhow, I hit the canal and I went one way or the other and managed to find the headquarters. We did the same drill again, by which time the brigade had been got to Palestine and had been put on board trains and were then being taken by the Gaza Strip along the road there, up, and they were being taken up that way. And I then set off again. I hadn't a clue where the book was. All to me, it was just miles and miles of unknown sand. And so there my sun compass did its work over. It wasn't very good. At least they showed you roughly where you were going. So after about, maybe four or five, might have been about 4 or 5 days, I think it was, I cut into the coast, that's right, and I managed to hit near Mersamatru. And then got myself orientated out and left the same instructions. And then I went from there to El Adem, which was then the railhead. And the farthest point at which the water supplies were. And then I waited at El Adem and went to Tobruk. And my timing wasn't far out because within 2 or 3 days the advance guards of the troops had arrived and I'd been able to get a hold of the OC of the area. And when Trasher Nichols came up, we found we were taking over part of the Gazala line from the... from the South Africans, and we took part of the Gazala line over, and then we were developing the defences there. We had South Africans on the right, and we had the 150 Brigade on the left, and in that situation we were in what were called boxes.
Could you just explain that for people?
Well, a box, well, you were in a defensive area. You usually had 2 units fairly well forward and a third unit in reserve behind. And the whole of the perimeter, you had a layer of mattress wiring, which was barbed wire laid flat like a mattress and pegged out about 6 inches from the ground. And that might be 300 or 400 yards deep. And you then hung on all sorts of things like booby traps and grenades and mines and things, so anybody coming across it would do himself a bit of no good. And then beyond that, you had a minefield of about 0.5 mile, 1/4 mile. And then beyond that, you had outposts. And then beyond that, you had listening posts. And they were all interlinked.
So there were known paths or gaps in the mattress wire and the...
You had white tape, which you had the gaps, and every night you sent patrols out every night. You went out on patrol every night. And you went in, and every gap was covered by a gap-covering party. And as the patrol came up, they would take the mines out. And the patrol would pass through and put the mines back. And they wouldn't take them out again until the patrol came back and recognized itself. You see, this was a drill. And then we would, we had a, probably a platoon would be out to the each outpost. And then the platoon would send a few men out forward to a listening post.
What would a listening post consist of then?
One man and two. One man and, well, one corporal and two, say. And he would go out and dig himself in. And he would remain there and he would merely listen and report back enemy patrols or anything that happened to be in the area. It was a vast area, you see. It was a vast area. You.
How would he report back?
Well, he would report back by... we used to run out a landline. We used to report back by a landline. But it was, it's a vast area, and troops found themselves very isolated. A corporal and two men might find themselves in the middle of a desert or something, about half a mile away from another two.
So they'd just dig in a hole?
Yes, the hole was prepared with fire steps and a little bunker, yes. They'd be dug in, yes.
Would the bunker be concrete or just...
Oh, no, no, just sand and sandbags.
And then the actual platoon post, the advance post, what would that consist of? Just the, more of the same?
Except it was properly set out as a defensive position. It would be sighted in depth. You would have two sections forward and one back with gaps between them. The trenches would be irregular. The guns would be sighted for all-round defence. Mines would be put round it. It was a miniature fortress, a little fortress.
And then when you got back through the minefield and the mattress, what would be at the centre? How, what dispositions would you arrange there?
Well, inside, of course, we had the three battalions and the gunners, the 25-pounders, and any supporting arms, might have been tanks, sappers, or anything else, inside the perimeter. Once a day at night, vehicles would come up from Tobruk and bring the supplies or water. Water trucks would come up, you see, because you had to have everything. It had to come by night. Sand was... everything you ate was sand.
Would there be actual defensive sighted battalion positions within
the... Every one was sighted in the same way as a defensive position. So that it was all the thing. It was all round defence and defence in depth. And sighted in such a way that we could make forays out.
And this was the Ghazala box that you...
This was the Ghazala box.
What was life like in one of these boxes? What sort of, to start with, what sort of personal accommodation would you have? Where would you sleep at that time?
Well, the ground wasn't... Sometimes it was sandy, sometimes it was rocky. If it was rocky, you couldn't dig down, and you used to have to build your defences by piling stone sangars up above you. That was unfortunate. If you came under fire, of course, these stones chipped, and they were very unpleasant to be in.
What was it like in the Ghazala one? Was that stone?
Well, one or two stone ones, but mostly we were fairly down. There was a salt pan not far away, and we could dig down. The ground around it was we dug down, and we made dugouts. They were very elaborate for the time that everybody had, they had roof over them, and a couple of sandbags over the top, and sandbag bunk, and a communication trench, and a road up to the fire step. At night, of course, every post was connected by wire, because if you got out at night, you couldn't see where you were going, and you had to go anywhere. So you had to get the wire and go by wire. And, of course, that was the way you signaled to each other at night, if you heard an enemy attack, all commanders tied string around them or wire around them, and the lookout post just gave a tug if they wanted to awaken them. We stood to every morning for an hour before dawn, an hour afterwards, and also stood to at dusk. Midday, there was never much doing because the sun was so hot it produced a sort of a mirage. You couldn't tell whether it was a blade of grass or a camel. Not seem to it, but activity was in the morning. Morning patrols, evening patrols, German armored cars buzzing around, our own armored cars buzzing around, Italian and German air attacks. The danger, of course, was that if you were traveling in a vehicle along the open desert, these things used to come out of the air and shoot you up. You had no protection. You couldn't get into any trees or anything. There was nothing. Nothing at all.
What would you... the daily routine, what about as a brigade staff? You were on the still...
Yes, yeah, at that time, yes.
What did you have to do then? What was your daily routine on the staff in the Gazala?
Well, of course, I did my standing too with everybody else. We got all our weapons. I checked all the weapons of the chaps that I had and all our defensive things. All the routine that the ordinary soldier did, we did. Then I got down to a normal office routine, all the signals coming in of what to do and what, you know, all the records. I used to get all the situation reports and all that sort of business coming in. I'd meet an intelligence officer and I'd meet the brigade major and we'd discuss things. There was always something to be done. There was somebody injured or casualties to be dealt with, and there was re-equipment, and there was either the water hadn't come and went on half rations, or the water tasted of salt, or somebody hadn't got any clothes, and somebody wanted complaints about he hadn't had a letter from home. And, you know, it's the sort of thing that you would expect would in any community that's been there for a little time. It went on all the time.
Would you work right through this midday sort of quiet
period? I would, because at that quiet period, you see, I'd go down into the dugout and read the books and the papers and the standing orders. And then, of course, we were always sending out jock columns.
What were the jock columns? Could you explain that?
Well, a jock column, the job of the jock column would be to either to patrol an area and be sufficiently strong to take on any enemy unit, or specifically to go out as an attacking patrol to do a particular job, such as to beat up an air landing strip or shoot up some Italians or get some prisoners, or generally to dominate the whole of no man's land between yourself and the Boche. And they consisted of a company of infantry, an anti-tank gun detachment, 40, some 25-pounders, and carriers and 3-inch mortars. And possibly, well, we have Marmon, Harrick and armoured cars might come with us, a South African one, or perhaps a light tank. We'd then be getting some things called honey tanks, which had come from America. They were sort of reconnaissance tanks.
Who decided which troops went with the jock column?
Or the brigade
rota, or were the specific troops who were regarded as particularly good, you know, then picked for it?
Well, everything you did in the army, of course, is on a rota, so that everybody gets a fair crack at the whip. So that you would nominate duty battalions, they would nominate duty companies, and they would nominate duty platoons. Now, apart from that, you would have specialist groups. We would have certain men who specialised in what they call the battle patrol. And they, of course, would go out to do specific tasks. The REs, accompanied by certain people, would go out and blow things up or lay mines. There was a fair amount of specialist stuff, but it was all coordinated and done in such a way that troops all had a reasonable chance of rest in those sort of conditions.
So the jock column was by rota?
Yes, a jock column. And the brigade commander would nominate the company commander who would do it, and his company, in conjunction with the commanding officer of the battalion. And then with the attached arms, they would nominate all the specialist arms, so that the jock column was an ad hoc unit.
Would a member of the brigade staff go with it?
No, not normally.
Did you ever have to go with one?
Yes, I went with one. After the Roscoe lost, and I went and commanded a company.
We'll come to that later then. Do you remember any particular jock columns and the results that they did or didn't achieve while you were at brigade staff before you?
There were quite a number of jock columns went out, and they came back having achieved what they had to do. I mean, they would come back and say that we went out and we occupied an area so-and-so, and they themselves put out a listening post, and that listening post came back and reported armoured fighting vehicles of a strength of so-and-so, lagered up at so-and-so. That type of column, you see, would seek information.
And that would come back to you?
It would come back through brigade, and I would find this out from the battle board. I'd find all this information coming in.
All the battle board system that we discussed earlier, that was all still...
Is standard practice. And then every night the aircraft would give us a sit-rep situation of what was happening on the front from the air. We would get that every night.
That would be incorporated in?
That would be incorporated in the general sit-rep and the whole thing put on the battle board.
Now, just a bit about ordinary life, what sort of food did you have at the time?
Well, the thing
in
is...
the box?
It was hardtack. We were entitled and got 14 ounces of biscuit and 12 ounces of bully beef per day. We got half a gallon of water per day, of which one quart went in your water bottle and the rest went into the cookhouse, things like that. Nothing was fresh. We sometimes, if it was a treat, we might get a tin of pineapples or something would come up from somewhere. But it was all hardtack. And, of course, everybody, we were down to virtually post-cooking. That is, we couldn't cook as a battalion. At times, we couldn't even cook as a company. You would cook as a platoon.
There wouldn't be anything to cook, though, would there?
Well, you did. You'd be surprised what these fellows did. You see, you had a tinny bully beef, and it was so hot that you buried it in the sand. If you didn't bury it in the sand, it poured out like olive oil. It was all melted. So you waited till night, and you dug it up. And then you made all sorts of things, like bully fritters. And you would get flour sent up, and you would roll the bits of bully beef and flour and fry it. There were bulletins sent round, bits of paper, giving you 57 varieties of how to cook bully beef. It was Boy Scouting, really down to Boy Scouting.
And this would be done, that would be done by the individuals, not by the company cooks?
Not necessarily. Could be done by the company cooks if they happened to be in an area, but if the forward area, they would be done by groups of men, a section cooking. You see, one would be nominated cook for the day. And he would do it.
He'd just collect all the stuff
and he would make something and make up something.
Was bully beef an appropriate diet, do you think? If it's slightly salty and such, how did it go down?
What was the only thing you could? I mean, you couldn't think of giving anybody anything other than a type of bully beef because of the heat and the flies. Flies were a great problem. And, of course... every day we used to have to go around, officers used to have to go around and literally put ascorbic acid tablets on everyone's tongue, prevent them getting scurvy, you see, with the hardtack.
You literally did that?
Yes, you did that because you know what some of these chaps are. They say they did what this or they did what that, or the hell with that. I'm damn, I don't want any pills. And that's it. So you just said, right, tongue out, mate, pop it on his tongue. And then just said, right. And it wasn't long before it went down. And you watched him swallow it so he didn't keep it under his tongue and spit it out.
Each officer would be responsible?
Responsible for his particular men. And then he would delegate it down to sergeants. But it was a...
Were there any other supplements to your diet? I mean, like tablet supplements? Or was it just the ascorbic acid?
Oh, ascorbic acid we used to have. And then we used to get some ointment against desert sores.